Those of you who were here know that many, many things were said last time, probably a few too many. But I'm going to tell you right now what you need to know from last time. There basically was just the introduction of what should be an intuitive notion that was sort of, we tried to make it a little bit precise. The intuitive notion is subject matter, sentential subject matter, what a sentence is about. And the picture of it was roughly this, that subject matter, sentential subject matters go with kind of blurred visions of logical space where the difference between differences between worlds that don't affect how and why the sentence is true are maybe not quite invisible, but you can't really make them out. So it's like you're seeing logical space from a distance, which actually is appropriate. A sentence is true about a subject matter if the actual world is in the same blurry cell as some world where the sentence really, really is true. And I'll give like lots of examples today, none of them completely convincing, but all of them interesting. So the thing to remember is truth about a subject matter is there's the actual world is just like some other world with respect to that subject matter. And that other world, it really is true. In other words, the actual condition of things with respect to that subject matter is totally cool with the sentence being true. It could stay exactly, things could stay exactly the same in that respect, and it would be true. Okay. So today, partial truth. Partial truth makes us nervous. It even makes me nervous, and I'm the main advocate of partial truth. This is a quote from Tarski, "What is only half true is untrue. Truth cannot tolerate a more or less." And I call this kind of thing a puritanical attitude about truth. And I think we all kind of feel it a little bit. I'm going to give an analogy first, an over-the-top analogy, just to sort of like get you in a certain frame of mind. It comes from Melanie Klein, the child psychologist. She had the view that newborns face, in a few months, a very significant developmental challenge. What they're going to have to do is they're going to have to realize, this is supposed to happen at 4 months, that the things in their environment that actually please them and the things in their environment that actually, you know, bother them are often the very same things. So they've got to sort of combine the notion of like a good thing and a bad thing. It could be the very same thing. Okay, and if it doesn't happen, she says it's supposed to happen at age 4 months, but when you hear more about it, you might wonder about that. If it doesn't happen, then you get the pathology known as black-white thinking. You get sort of people that just can't kind of bear in mind that things have good and bad sides. So the kind of people that, like, the way their attitude towards you is like totally based on the last thing you said to them. They're mad at you if you said something that wasn't nice, and they love you if the other way around. So it's not a good way to be, black-white thinking. I can remember sitting with my son and watching, I guess it was Shrek. He was about 4, and he was like squirming around in his seat, and he couldn't get comfortable, and I was trying to figure out what was going on, and eventually he said, is donkey a good donkey or a bad donkey, right? He couldn't actually kind of enjoy the movie until donkey had been classed. That's a little bit of black-white thinking there. So you see it in kids, and it's understandable there, but if you were like watching TV with a neighbor, and they turned to you and said, so this Vladimir Putin fellow, you know, good? Or bad, right? You think the person like has got a very backward, primitive way of thinking about things. But it's almost as though having outgrown, actually, Klein calls this early stage that you're supposed to get through, the paranoid schizoid stage. It's almost as though having got through that stage and made our peace with the combination of good and bad in a single object, we didn't have the energy left to do the same thing on the side of truth. Because, well, it seems totally kind of weird for someone to insist on knowing if Vladimir Putin is good full stop or bad full stop, it's considered sort of forthright and healthy-minded and got a sign of sort of a good methodology if you insist on knowing whether certain hypotheses are true full stop or false full stop. That's a good thing to do on the whole. So I want to talk about this a little bit. So one reason for discomfort with partial truth is that the notion really has been used in some horrible, disreputable causes, more in this country than in mine. So one cause is People have used partial truth to downgrade perfectly deserving truths. So there's the idea that the idealists had, that Bradley had, that if something is less than the whole truth, then that's a mark against how much it is true. If it's not the whole truth, it's only partly true. So that's downgrading the truth. Idealists also sometimes use partial truth to sort of upgrade falsehoods. This is a funny quote from Russell. He says, some theories have tacitly assumed that all our beliefs are true. I've been trying to figure out who exactly he means. I have a hypothesis. He says, they have then had to add a postscript explaining that what we call error is really partial truth. If we think it is Tuesday when it is really Wednesday, we are at least right in thinking that it is a day of the week. If we think that Columbus discovered America in 1066, we are at least right in thinking that something important happened in that year. So there's this kind of Platonic idea that I guess was picked up by Joachim, and I think maybe Bradley too, that you know your beliefs can't really get in the reality representation kind of business at all unless you're somehow in touch with the world, and that being somehow in touch with the world is construed as partial truth. So those are kind of nutty ideas, but we're not going to get anywhere close to them, because our notion of partial truth, if it's the same as theirs, they're wrong, and if it's different, we don't have to worry. So here's the difference. So partial truth for us is just defined as truth of a part. If you remember, B is a part of A if the inference AB is truth-preserving and subject matter-preserving. The subject matter of B is part of the subject matter of A. And I said a little bit about what that was, but I'm not going to go back over it now. So let's see if these Bradley ideas get any purchase, if that's how we're doing things. So suppose I say, here's something that's less than the whole truth. So like, I'm hungry. That's less than the whole truth. Are you inclined to say, well, since there's some truth that isn't in there, there must be some falsehood that is in there? Because that's what it really would be to say, since something is only, you know, not the whole truth, it can only be partly true. Because there's no good inference from S does not contain all the truth, therefore S is not thoroughly true. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that inference. The other kind of step that the other idea that I just mentioned was that what seems false really is just a little bit true. But the way we're thinking of it, to be a little bit true would mean it would have to have true parts. I'm thinking non-trivial true parts. But falsehoods don't have to have true parts. Some do. If I say snow is white and expensive, there's a true part. But if I say everything is suffused with orgone energy or some crank concept from Wilhelm Reich or something like that. Is that his name? That there's no truth to that. Now, yeah, there's nothing right about that. And with regard to Russell's example, something happening important in 1066 can't be the truth in Columbus discovered America in 1066 because it isn't even part of it. Because to be part of it, it would have to be implied by it. It's not even implied by it. Okay. I do wonder whether there is another thing in there that's true, which is Columbus discovered America. That's a topic for another day. Okay, so I say truth Puritanism is wrong. So what? I mean, who's been hurt by it? Has anyone really been hurt by the kind of irrational insistence on not letting a tiny drop of falsity get into our claims? Well, let's ask ourselves, what motive could there possibly be for saying false things with true bits in them as opposed to just the true bits themselves? There's a passage in William James that does not actually bear the interpretation I'm going to give it at all, but is can be interpreted to actually give a good answer to this. The passage is, and you've probably heard it, a rule of thinking which would absolutely prevent me from acknowledging certain kinds of truth, if those kinds of truth were really there, would be an irrational rule. So as we know, that's supposed to be a plea for epistemic boldness. We should use methods that kind of run the risk of, letting some false beliefs into our head if that's the price of getting some interesting true beliefs into our head. Okay, so James is thinking, we might let false belief, B come in order that true belief A won't be kept out. But you could also hear James is making a plea for semantic boldness. Semantic boldness would be, unlike this statement false statement tolerated for the truth of this other statement, it would be a false statement tolerated for the truth of the truth it itself contains. Okay? So semantic boldness would be, can we tolerate or should we tolerate some false statements for the truth that they themselves contain? And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So there's this idea of maybe some truths come wrapped in larger falsehoods. They're only or best or most efficiently kind of accessed in that little kind of false package. I gave a construction last time, and I mentioned it again today, of how you find like the part of A about a certain subject matter M. And if you remember the way I did it, I just said what world the part was true in. So all I was really doing is I was taking a sentence that had some, you know, that was really false, and I was constructing a proposition that one might hope would be wholly true. Okay, so we've got this proposition, but we don't have a sentence that expresses it. We can point to the proposition, we can endorse it, we can plant our flag in it, but we can't assert it if assertion requires having a sentence that expresses it. But if we can't assert this sentence, we want to do something assertive to recognize it. What other option do we have but to assert something a little bit stronger, but to overshoot the mark, and then somehow indicate to our audience that the part of it that you should really, that you're advocating for is blah, the part about a certain subject matter. So someone says, you're lying. Like I had the famous philosopher said to Sally in the first message, you know, you shouldn't say that there's a gain and loss of properties unless there's properties. If someone says you're lying, you know, the plea is guilty with an excuse. I realize I'm saying something that is or maybe false, but it's not easy to assert just the true part, and I tried to clue you in to which part that was, the part about a certain subject matter. Okay. This is a section I'm going to skip about something, the logic of partial truth. I'm just going to go straight to some examples. And let me just say, I'm swinging for the fences here. I'm not sure any of these examples really kind of totally work, but they're interesting. Okay. First example, standards of precision. So if you ask me my height, I will say I am 5'9". What I say is false. I am actually closer to 5'8.5". It is my view that to be closer to 5'8.5" than 5'9" entails not being 5'9". You can't be less than a certain height and that height at the same time. So it's false what I say. Why does it sound right? Well, when people are throwing around height measures, they're usually talking about a certain subject matter, height to the nearest inch. Right? Your height to the nearest inch is the number n such that n inches minus your height, or the absolute value of that difference, has the, you know, the smallest value it could. Okay, that's what height to the nearest inch is. So is I am 5'9" true about height to the nearest inch? Well, it depends if we can morph our world into one where it really is true that I'm 5'9" without disrupting the state of affairs with respect to the subject matter of height in inches. In other words, can we change heights in this world in such a way that nobody changes their height in inches, but it now becomes really true that I'm 5'9"? Sure, just boost me a little bit till I'm 5'9". That's all it takes. So that's why it's true about height in inches that I'm 5'9". Francis Hexagonal. You might think, well, you know, it's not. People say, well, what's going on there? And Francis, roughly hexagonal, what's the force of the roughly? Well, maybe it's something like this. Francis Hexagonal isn't really true. It's partly true. It's true about a certain subject matter. What's the subject matter? I'm not getting what I said. It's true about, say, approximate shape, where I kind of define very kind of loosely approximate shape as the the one closest to actual shape in the sense of, say, minimizing the area of non-overlap. And you've got to have some sort of fairly small finite list of memorable shapes, like the triangular square, etc. Otherwise, you could just have, like, the shape of France would be one of the shapes. Okay. So I could have said, of course, that 5'9" is the height in inches closest to my height, and I could have said that hexagonal is the regular memorable shape closest to the shape of France. But this is, you know, ugly and inconvenient, and it sort of gets kind of pedantic about something that's totally understood anyway. It requires explicitness about something that we shouldn't have to be explicit about. So better to stick with the first claim, I'm going to say, and let the part presented as true just sort of track the issue under discussion. The very same sentence out of my mouth can actually make different contributions to different conversations depending on what's going on in those conversations. Some of those contributions might not be right, so that's the next issue. Imagine my friend Deb says, you know, as a matter of fact, I'm 6'1¼". Okay, and now I'm reluctant to repeat that I'm 5'9". Why? Well, if someone says they're 6'1¼", you ask, why do they stick on the quarter? They must think that what they said would have been false about what they meant to be talking about. So they must have been talking about height to the nearest quarter inch. But if we're talking about height to the nearest quarter inch, then it's no longer true that I'm 5'9". So that's why I won't repeat myself. Now there's an interesting side issue here that is mentioned by Lewis in the following passage. He's talking about shifts in boundaries. I think he's talking about quantifier domains. You know, like if I say there's no beer in the fridge and you open the door and you see a drop of beer on the bottom, you can say, yes, there's this drop, and it sort of seems as though you kind of got the better of me, even though I was meant to be talking about drinkable beer. Lewis says, for some reason, the boundary readily shifts outward if what is said requires it, but does not so readily shift inward if what is said requires that. Because of this asymmetry, we may think that what is true with respect to the outward shifted boundary must be somehow more true. So my proposal is, what we may think is correct. It is actually more true. So why is it that the boundary shifts outward but not in? Because the person who is speaking to the larger subject matter is basically, they're basically kind of proposing to stop ignoring certain genuine falsifiers of the sentence being uttered. The person who says, I'm not going to ignore the reasons these sentences are false, has the semantic high ground. It's hard to just go back, you know. Another reason why it's hard to roll it back is, suppose I say, I am 5'9", thinking that's true about height in inches. But saying 5'9" doesn't make it clear whether I'm talking about height in inches or height in quarter inches. Saying 6'1¼" does make it clear. So the more kind of precise height measure actually makes it clear that you want to boost the subject matter under discussion, whereas the coarser one doesn't make it clear that you want to reduce it. Okay, so that's the first kind of soften you up. Idea about how it might actually make sense to say things that aren't entirely true. Here's the second. So imagine that we are like Kabbalistic numerological rabbis, and we have a very strange interpretation of Genesis. So when God on the fifth day told the animals to go forth and multiply, he really meant, you know, that was fourth with a U in it, right? He meant that there should be four times as many animals on a day as on the previous day, and let's just suppose that there were three animals to begin with. This is their view. So then, if you ask them how many animals there should be on the nth day, they say 3 × 4⁻⁵. Remember, they set it on the fifth day. Okay. We're the rabbis. Our reading of Numbers, which comes a little bit later. I don't know if you've noticed this, but you know, Numbers has a lot of very implausible estimates of like how many Israelites were in various places, and it probably just destroyed their confidence in the whole business of the existence of Numbers. And so they actually decide on the basis of their reading of Numbers that God never got around to creating 3, 4, and 5. Well, how much should it bother them or us? Well, you might say if it's enough for Lupoli that Falstaff's testimony was true about his client Jones, who is the person he was trying to make a representation about, then why wouldn't it be enough for us rabbis if the statement coming out of our mouth is true about how many animals there are on a given day? That seems like it would be a pretty good defense of our claim, since we weren't speaking to mathematical ontology, we were just trying to sort of get across how many animals on a given day. We could have said, you know, 3 animals on the first day, and 12 on the second, and 48 on the third, and so. But you know, eventually you run out of breath. Okay, so if you use numbers, and you let yourself talk about numbers, and you sort of let your audience understand, as certainly we all do understand, that you don't mean to be making a point about mathematical ontology, the problem is solved. You can express what would have been an infinite conjunction in just finite compass. Okay, so here's an objection that I'm almost afraid to mention, but I'm not afraid enough, apparently. So here's what you might say. Your construction of the physical part of the other example that I want to work with is the rate of star formation is exponentially decreasing. We might say that to say something about how often stars are coming along these days. We want that to be true about stars. If you imagine a physics professor telling you this, and then she overhears you later telling a friend, "I have it from the physics professor that there are exponential functions," right? That would be very strange. She was not testifying to the issue of whether there are exponential functions. That was sort of the medium, if you like, not the message. So here's the objection. Your construction of the physical part of the star formula, suppose we're anomalous, we don't believe in numbers. The construction of the physical part of the star formula essentially alludes to another world that's just like ours in physical respects, but has numbers or has functions or whatever it might be. And you might say, look, don't nominalists and Platonists and everybody else agree that mathematical objects, or at least pure ones, exist necessarily, or they're necessary or they're impossible? And so if you're a nominalist, you should think numbers are impossible, and therefore you shouldn't actually credit the idea of a world just like ours physically that has numbers in it. I have so many things I want to say about this that it's going to be hard for me to actually keep it down to an manageable number, but I'm going to try to, I think I might be going with three. So one thing might be said is, it's not really true that nominalists and Platonists agree about that. I've got like six or seven papers there in the side part. But there's some better things you could say. One thing you could say is, okay, I mean, look, if I really am trying to use numbers to kind of get across something about the planets, it's not really clear why the necessary existence of numbers is important to that, you know? So why don't I just postulate things like numbers, but they're contingent, call them schmumbers, okay? So when I say, number of animals on the nth day is 3 times 4 to the exponent n minus 5, just take me to be talking about schmumbers, okay? Maybe there aren't any actual ones, but these are contingent, and so no problem introducing them to the next world. The third thing I want to say is, look, the mere fact that it's, this is a funny thing to call a mere fact, that something is impossible, the mere fact, you're not going to sort of back up because something's impossible. The mere fact that something is impossible overall does not entail that it is impossible relative to certain constraints, okay? So Kit Fine has this like example that everybody knows. We can suppose for argument's sake, now we're Platonists, that Socrates exists in exactly the same worlds as Singleton Socrates, the set whose only member is Socrates. And that seems kind of weird because you feel that Singleton Socrates somehow depends on Socrates and not the other way around. So you've got Socrates is essentially accompanied by Singleton Socrates. Does that mean that when Aristotle was writing about the essence of Socrates, he left something out? He didn't mention that there's a singleton Socrates following him around? No. It seems like there is a real kind of asymmetry here. Socrates pertains to the nature of singleton Socrates, but not the other way around. And the way Fine develops this is he says, look, things aren't just necessary or impossible to cur, they're necessary or impossible in virtue of the nature of certain items. Or more generally, you could say, flowing from certain sources. So it's part of the nature of Singleton, too, that Socrates exists, but it isn't part of the nature of Socrates that Singleton, too, exists. You can think of it as like a semantic analogy. It's part of the meaning of bachelor that bachelors are unmarried, but it's not part of the meaning of unmarried that if an unmarried person is also male, that they're a bachelor. Okay. Okay. So I want to say, look, what you might call relatively possible worlds, worlds possible as far as blah is concerned, might be just as good for expressive purposes as really possible worlds. There's many foundational issues that I'm obviously running roughshod over and will continue to even if you ask me about it. But it might work just as well for our purposes. And now all I have to say for the application to the Kabbalistic application is I say, look, maybe numbers are, or functions are impossible But they're possible as far as the physical world is concerned. Whatever it is that stops them from existing, it isn't that the physical world lodges some objection. It says, I won't tolerate being accompanied by numbers. I don't know what the source of the impossibility or necessity would be. I mean, I think Feynman has trouble with this as well. But we can be pretty sure that there's nothing about us that's sort of crying out for that kind of accompaniment, or at least that's the line that we could take. Okay, third example. Intentional identity. So this is the old hobnob problem. This is a sentence that Geach came up with. This is, I actually just looked at the sentence. It's way more complicated. It involves four characters I hadn't realized. Hobbes believes that Cobb did something and Nob. Yeah. Okay, I got two characters. Hob and Nob. Hob believes a witch burned down his barn, and Nob believes that she, that same witch, blighted his mare. I just say that because I like to say the word blighted. So one issue here is syntactic. There's that word she in the second conjunct, and it seems like that she involves some kind of anaphoric back reference, but it also seems as though the intended kind of back reference is only going to be possible if there's like a wide scope quantifier in front. There is a witch. You know, Hob thinks she did this, Nob thinks she did that. But of course, since there isn't any such witch, it wouldn't be true if you put the wide scope quantifier in front. That would say there is a witch, blah, blah, blah. So that's a syntactic issue. I want to talk about a semantic issue that's probably less discussed. So what Geach says, I think, if I remember right, is that, you know, what you're trying to get at when you say this, is speaking very loosely, is that Hobbes and Nob's belief have a common focus in a way that somehow intuitively kind of survives the realization that there was no single thing they were both thinking about. So that's what the sentence was trying to get at, the common focus between Hobbes and Nob's mental states. Okay, but you might say, look, there was a common focus. And if that's what the sentence was trying to get at, then it better be true. Shouldn't it be true if it's going to succeed in cluing us into this common focus? Well, that depends on what the threat to its truth would be. If the threat to its truth is something orthogonal to the issue of common focus, then no, it might as well be false as far as the project of communicating to us this fact about common focus. So I take it the reason that it's false, that the hobnob sentence is false, is that has to do with what happened just before the fire. There wasn't a witch there lighting a match. Okay, it was like somebody knocked over a lantern or something like that. Okay. So that's what's wrong with the hobnob sentence. But we weren't talking about that, to paraphrase my daughter, we weren't talking about that. We weren't talking about the witch that supposedly lit the fire, because we both knew full well there wasn't such a witch. Okay, we were talking about something to do with the common focus of the two mental states. So given that that's the case, what is it to us if the sentence as a whole is false? We want it to be true about the part of reality, so to speak, that subserves the common focus of their mental states. Well, this is going to look very widely from case to case, but in this case, you know, a not implausible suggestion is, since we knew that, you know, the part before the fire wasn't the way the sentence says, well, let's just talk about the fire and everything after those events. When I say Hob and Nob are thinking about the same witch, I'm saying that's true as far as events since the fire are concerned, which means that it could really be true. All you have to do to make it really be true is you don't have to change anything since the fire. You just have to plug the witch in before it. That's all that's missing, so to speak, the witch before it. Okay. So there's a way in which the hobnob sentence is like what it seems to say, then minus there is a witch, which might seem like, how can you subtract, you know, isn't that subtracting hobbits from Lord of the Rings or something like that? But you can actually make sense of it because you've indicated the subject matter you mean to be talking about. It's, you know, events since the fire. You say, you know, you can scour that whole, like, space-time territory. You won't find a single thing that's, like, unhappy with the truth of the there being a witch that blah, blah, blah. Therefore, the statement is right about those events. Okay. Laws and models. So Galileo discovered that distance fallen grows with the square of the time elapsed. It's Galileo's law of falling bodies. He discovered that. Well, then, that's a fact of verb, right? So, but how could he have discovered it if it's not really true? that distance fallen grows with the square of the time elapsed. It's not really true because of friction, because of possible electromagnetic interference, who knows what else. I don't even know what all the things are that could prevent it from being true. So I'll just assume that it focused on friction and that the fall actually takes a little bit longer than Galileo thought. Not that I imagined he would give us an argument about this. Okay, so here's a reply that you sometimes hear. You are so naive. Laws are not supposed to be true in reality. They are true in idealized models where these complications are absent. And let's suppose that there's something right about that, that law statements, or at least some of them, aren't supposed to be true in reality. Nevertheless, they shouldn't be silent about reality either. It shouldn't be like we can make any law claim that we like, and if someone says, that doesn't seem right, you say, oh, my claim had no import for the actual world. Obviously, it's supposed to have some kind of import for the actual world. What kind of import? So I want to say, yeah, there's something about our world that you're getting at when you say that the law is true about another world that so corresponds to the model. What is it? So translation schemes, if you look through the model literature, which I almost have, you find a lot of translation schemes whereby people sort of tell you what the claim T of S is about the actual world that you can read off the fact that S is true of the given model. And some of the, I have some examples down here. So the translation of S might be, S worlds are sort of isomorphically embeddable in the actual world. And so whatever, maybe this, obviously these are very not well developed the way I'm doing it. Or maybe R world is somehow analogous to an S world or resembles an S world in some specified respect. Or R world is such as to make the statement S kind of pretend true in a certain story or game that's suggested by the other world in question. So here's a simple-minded alternative, which I'm just wondering how far you can go with it. So S's truth in another world testifies not to the total truth here of some other statement that you find by dreaming up the right translation function, but it testifies to the partial truth here of the sentence that came out of your mouth. You don't need to find a new sentence. The sentence that you used was just fine. You just have to figure out what you were trying to get right when you said that. Well, the natural thought in the case of Galileo is, well, he's trying to get right, like, gravitational motion, or we're trying to get right gravitationally induced motion. Now, let me say something. Here comes a dark saying. Actually, I want to say, look, there really isn't literally in the world such a thing as gravitationally induced motion. The apple falls once. The fall of the apple does not harbor within it a longer or shorter fall that's sort of unencumbered by friction. It's just the one fall. You know, we're used to thinking about, you know, there's all these different things and you add them together and blah, 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 you get a certain result. But the actual world just does not contain this faster fall. It's not there. So what are we doing? Well, remember last time I said very quickly that there's a problem with the explication of constructive empiricism where you say it's trying to get observables right. Because among observables, there's the sun. And to get the sun right, you have to get nuclear fusion right. But it's not supposed to be a requirement on an empirically adequate theory that it get nuclear fusion right. Okay, it's only supposed to sort of save the appearances. And I said, but there's something very close to observables, those items, that maybe you could substitute in, which is observation, the subject matter. In fact, David Lewis, in the paper where he develops some of the subject matter stuff, it's called Statements Partly About Observation, and he develops this notion of observation. So what would it mean then? It's not observation. That was in the case of the constructive empiricist. In this case, rather than there being like an item in the world, motion due to gravity, you say, I'm talking about that, and you point to it. Rather, there's a subject matter, bold-faced motion due to gravity, and you're trying to be correct about that. I have to get this, I have to stick this in somewhere. This is as good a time as any. I mean, one way to think of the difference, this is what I always say to myself to sort of remember the difference between an item and a subject matter. Oscar Wilde, right, this famous joke, he says, you make a pun on any subject. He says, how about the queen? He says, the queen is not a subject. Okay. So the queen is not a subject. But he was like, it was actually prescient, because he could even have meant subject matter. The queen is not a subject matter, but you bold her, and then she is. Okay, so bold the queen is a subject matter, plain type the queen is not a subject matter. Okay. So that's the claim, that Galileo's law would be true about motion due to gravity. I realize that's not strictly true even about that, because it's not always the same distance from the Earth, but never mind. This is subject matter, motion due to gravity. It lumps slow fall worlds together with their fast fall counterparts. Galileo's law is true of it. On what condition? Well, it's got to be true, period, in a frictionless counterpart of our world. That's just the same with respect to motion due to gravity, which I take to mean something like the dynamic laws insofar as they're attending to what gravity does are the same. In that world where gravity calls the shots, Galileo was right about that world. Therefore, he was right about motion due to gravity in our world. Now, here's something even more, I'm even less qualified to say. One can imagine a no separate item view, not just about motion due to gravity, but also about the component forces acting on the apple. So you might say, look, the force on an apple is not, despite all the diagrams you make in physics class, it's not literally an amalgam of various competing subforces like duking it out, right? There really is just the total force on the apple. Well, what's going on then when you put a law forward like, say, Coulomb's law that's supposed to talk about, say, electrostatic force? Well, you're talking about force exerted by slow-moving charges. Okay, so you go to another world that's just like ours with respect to force exerted by slow-moving charges, and it's free of other distractions, and Coulomb was right. Okay. Now, there's something kind of missing here. Total force has got to break down into components somehow, and we have to sort of explain what all those sort of parallelogram of forces diagrams were really doing. So one idea is that the truth about total force can be patched together from the truth in one world of Coulomb's law, the truth in another world of law of gravitation, the truth in another world of some law of magnetism. How do you do it? You take the force vector from one, and the force vector from the other, and from the third, and you just add them together in this well-understood way. You just add the vectors together. So this does not have to be seen as literally combining forces, which always kind of seemed a little bit like a strange idea, as though there were these aspirational forces there that kind of were prevented from showing their face because they were drowned out by other forces or something like that, like merely potential for something like that. You don't have to see it that way. You don't have to see it as combining forces. You can see it as combining the state of things with respect to two smaller force-ish subject matters to obtain the state of things with respect to a larger force-ish subject matter. So the truth about force is, at least I've just been assuming, not itself terribly simple, but can be recovered from truths about other subject matters where those truths are simple. We value those lesser subject matters precisely because there's simple truths that fully describe them. You might think the same goes more generally. So there's this kind of idea, that the laws that you learn, that are written down in physics books, they're all getting at part of the situation. Maybe they're not all strictly true, but somehow if you patch together what all of them were saying, you'd get like a full understanding of what's going on in the world. And this is, I can't remember what this is called, but Nancy Cartwright doesn't like this idea. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about Nancy Cartwright's suggestion that it's just an article of faith, probably born of over-reliance on this example with forces, that you can always do that. You can always recover the total situation from the situations governed by simple laws. So here's a way of thinking about it. So here's the subject matter. You'll see I'm going to get extremely loose and what I'm willing to call a subject matter. But there's an total nomological circumstances in this world, by which I mean sort of everything that goes into determining which constraints are in place on states of the world at a time, and goes into determining the evolution of states one to another. Okay. So that's total nomological circumstances. It's a very complicated matter, what constrains instantaneous states and determines evolution from one to the next. On the view that, at least I grew up with, that Cartwright doesn't like, that would mean that the state of things with respect to total nomological circumstances would have to be resolvable into the states of things with respect to a bunch of much simpler and smaller subject matters. And these smaller ones would be along the lines of, instead of like the total one is the rule, however complicated, that constrains instantaneous state and blah, blah, blah. The partial one is the quite simple rule that constrains instantaneous state and governs evolution, if you just leave some of the junk out, where different bits of junk are left out in different of those subject, in those NKs. Well, it's just not at all obvious that that should be possible, whether it's, I'm in no position to tell, but there's at least sort of, makes it clear what the hostage to fortune is. You just can't assume if you've got a big complex subject matter, and you think I can't handle this, it's too complicated. I'll just plug in 52 smaller ones. The truth about them is quite simple, and I can recover the truth about the big one from the smaller ones. There's just no general reason to assume that that would be the case. Okay, next example: non-existence. So as you know, Pegasus does not exist. That sentence, "Pegasus does not exist," has like a paradoxical kind of self-undermining flavor, which is usually brought out as follows. Well, the empty name in that sentence makes it untrue. Okay, well, what makes it have an empty name? Why is that name empty? Because Pegasus doesn't exist, you want to say. So then it looks like the sentence "Pegasus does not exist" is untrue because Pegasus doesn't exist. So the form of that is sentence S is untrue because S. That seems really weird. That to explain why a sentence is untrue, I then use the sentence as though it's stating a fact in the world. So other weirdnesses along these lines is, you know, say this sentence is false. You can easily get yourself into a situation where you want to say, you know, this sentence is false, you know, is untrue if and because this sentence is false. Or another example is, you know, suppose I'm a nominalist, but I'm excitable and sort of I kind of reach for any old way of making my point. And I, you know, someone says to me, "I'll tell you how many numbers there are. The number of numbers is, you know, aleph naught, some bigger infinite number." And then I might want to respond and say, "The number of numbers is zero." I might want to say, "Well, that's a self-defeating claim, right? If it really is zero, then there's no such thing as the number of numbers." Okay. Yet somehow it seems like we can get away with it, right? You can't say the number is zero, and then go on to say, "I'll tell you the number of how many there are." It's zero. Yeah. Okay. So that's another case where you might want to say, the reason it's untrue that the number of numbers is zero is because that definite description is empty. Why is it empty? If you were the right man, you could say, because the number of numbers is zero. Right? So I'm just going to go back to the Pegasus case. So, any reason that we might have for denying truth to, say, Pegasus fails to exist, I'm going to suppose, applies also to a much simpler sentence. Pegasus is nowhere in this room right now. So why does Pegasus is nowhere in this room right now seem true? Well, you might argue that there's a subject matter goings on in this room, okay? And even if it's not really true that Pegasus doesn't exist, it's true about goings on in this room. Why? Because you could keep goings on in this room the same and move to a world where Pegasus is out in the hall trying to get in, right? And then it really is true that Pegasus is not in this room, okay? So rather than trying to make the sentence come out true, You just ask yourself, well, what was I really talking about? There's some intuition that you're talking about Pegasus. But that can't be right. You know, all there is, you know, the real stuff. So there's actually a nice paper by Jay Atlas. I don't know if I quoted it. Says, what are negative existential statements about? And he actually argues that they're not about Pegasus, they're about existence. And there's sort of tests you can use that would suggest that the topic is not Pegasus. If the topic was Pegasus, then we should be able to go like this. We'll change it to Aristotle. Say, topic Aristotle is something like, tell me about Aristotle. He's short, he stub-nosed, he exists. That isn't the question you hear Aristotle exists as answering. The question you hear it as answering is, what exists? Plato, Aristotle, blah, blah, blah. That sort of question-answer consonance is a good guide to what the topic of a sentence is. Okay. So there's nothing going on in this room, I say, to stop it being from really, really true that Pegasus is not in this room, because you just got to add Pegasus in elsewhere. I'm not going to worry at this moment about the question of, that Kripke worries about is, you know, if a thing doesn't exist, it's not clear it even could have existed. That's something we could talk about, maybe. But maybe we need to add something to this. It's not enough that there's a world that's just the same with respect to this room where Pegasus is not in this room is true. We probably don't want there to be a world that's just the same with respect to this room where Pegasus is in this room is true. So let's ask ourselves, why can't we make a world just like this one with regard to goings-on in this world where it's true that Pegasus is in here? Well, that's very hard to say, which I think is actually suggestive, because another thing that was hard to say without mentioning something we didn't want to was how the stars were behaving when we said that the star formation was declining exponentially. So when I go through this, think for a little bit about Pegasus as possibly a representational aid, helping us say otherwise very hard to say things about the actual world. So why is no one here qualified for the Pegasus role? Well, you know, there's just any number of reasons, but I take it everybody in this room, I'm sure we could have interviews, but everybody in this room has properties such that even granting that, you know, properties Q, says even granting that Hesperus could have turned out to exist, which Kripke doesn't want to grant, but I kind of feel I do want to grant, even granting that, it's not the case that Hesperus could have turned out to exist and had those properties. In other words, it's not the case that even as we get to the full truth about each of you, you know, so you say, you know, I'm a person. Maybe you could tell some story like where Hesperus, Pegasus actually turned out to be a person. You know, I didn't exist in Greek times. You know, I didn't know, Bellerophon or whatever. Just keep on adding stuff and stuff. Eventually, you're going to reach something so sufficient to ground the judgment that it could not have turned out that Hesperus was the thing with those properties, or so I suggest. Okay, well, you could expand the room, right? Pegasus is nowhere in Oxford. Pegasus is nowhere in the UK. Pegasus is nowhere in the solar system. And now we reach Pegasus does not exist, which, just to make it sound a little bit more like the other ones, I'm going to just introduce the word capital U.S., us, for everything that exists. You, me, and the lamppost, and Mars, and everything else. Okay, us is everything that exists. So the proposal would be that us plays the role of the room. So there's nothing. And both of these claims are kind of hard, and I'm not sure of either of them, but the proposal would be, there's nothing in our condition, and what's going on with us, to block the introduction of Pegasus as a further item. It might even be, I'm not sure, it would have to be, as a further Meinongian item. Even if we don't think Meinongianism is true, we might still think it's coherent. That's all it has to be for this purpose. In other words, it doesn't really much matter where we plug Pegasus in, as long as he doesn't come in for one of us. And so you might ask, well, why do we think that he could not have turned out to be one of us? Well, Again, I think you have to say, to have been one of us, you would have had to be you or me or etc. Those are the only ways of being one of us. And I suggest that every single one of us has disqualifying properties. Now, there's a question about the semantics of the word Pegasus. You might ask, where in the semantics of the word Pegasus do I find out that there are these disqualifying properties? One view would be, it's part of the meaning that Kripke actually convinced us that it's never, how do I put it here? You never find conditions such that, say, X can't be, say, Nixon, without satisfying those conditions. You can't find positive conditions on being Nixon. But that's not to say you can't find sufficient conditions for not being Nixon. You might well think competence with the word Nixon is not compatible with wondering whether this table is Nixon, no matter how much detail was piled on about the table. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe we're just pure, like, direct referentialists or millions or what, I don't know the difference between all those words. It might be, there might be some contexts, some grammatical contexts, in which a name's contribution to truth value is not via its semantic properties, but via some kind of meta-semantic properties. And indeed, that's what sort of Kripke suggests himself, because he links it could have turned out statements and a priori that statements, not to the referent of, say, a word like Neptune, but to the reference-fixing description. And what distinguishes him from Frege is that the reference-fixing description is not part of the meaning. It's something meta-semantical. It's some advice we give ourselves to remind ourselves, like, what is the reference supposed to be? Okay, so that's just pure Kripke. So why couldn't, again, Pegasus be bringing into this sentence some meta-semantical properties of the kind that Kripke allows? Okay, next example. Pure math. So we're back to being Kabbalistic rabbis. So we actually think, we think it's false that, you know, say the number of planets is 8 or something like that. We also think statements of pure math are false. So we think it's false that there are primes over 10. But, of course, like anybody else, we want to keep on saying it. No one has ever proposed, to my knowledge, well, maybe someone has, stop saying that kind of thing. Right? They want to keep on saying it. How is that okay? Well, if you want to continue on along the same lines as before, it's clear what we should say. The statement has a part that we do believe. It's a part that's true in our view and remains so regardless of questions of mathematical ontology. Okay, that's what we would do if we were sticking to the plan, but it's very hard to see what the true part of there are primes over 10 might be if there aren't any numbers. So doesn't it follow from the denial of numbers that, as Field says in Science Without Numbers, true-seeming existential claims, like the one I just mentioned, there are primes over 10, are actually trivially false, and false-seeming universal claims, like primes over 10 are even, are actually true. That your intuitions about the claim are just the opposite of what they should be. If Field is right about that, if true-seeming claims are trivially false and false are trivially true, then that seems to sort of not leave much room for substantive true parts of false claims. So the question is, does it actually follow, does Field's claim follow from the non-existence of numbers that the universal generalizations are all true and the existential are all false? I'm not sure that it does follow. So ask yourself this question. And don't ask yourself whether you think numbers exist. Maybe or even tell yourself you don't think they exist. Take primes over 10 are even, and primes over 10 are odd. Okay. You might feel kind of tugged towards the second one. Primes over 10 are even feels somehow wrong, even bracketing issues of mathematical ontology. Well, certainly primes over 10 are even is true if that statement is like an enumerative generalization kind of ranging over all the things that there happen to be, sort of like, you know, everyone in this room was born on a Tuesday or something like that. So we're not actually stating a sort of a trend in nature or anywhere else. We're just sort of saying there's no counterexamples to this. Okay. So if indeed these mathematical generalizations are enumerative generalizations, then Field is right. But standard tests for genericity suggests that they have some sort of generic force, like, you know, birds fly and fish swim and mosquitoes carry the West Nile virus, and so on and so forth. So what are some of the, let me give some other examples that might be suggestive here. So if indeed there is some generic force here, that's interesting, because there's substantive true claims with generic force that don't have any instances. In fact, some of the most famous laws of nature are, might well be like that. So here's an easy one, which doesn't mean much because, for reasons you'll see, like dodos can't fly. I hope I'm not misremembering, but I'm thinking they're flightless birds. So dodos can't fly. Yeah. That seems true. There aren't any dodos. Dodos can fly seems false. There aren't any dodos. Newton's whatever it is, first law of motion. A body not subject to any force remains in rest or at uniform motion. If indeed forces are like continuously varying quantities, you know, any real number can be the measure of the intensity of a force, then you might well think that it would be an incredible coincidence if at any moment in the history of the universe there was exactly zero force on an object. I've actually heard people who know about this say that, so I'm just repeating it. You know, certainly there's no, certainly we don't know. Nobody here knows that there's ever, that's ever happened. But you don't think, well, look, maybe objects with zero net force on them actually explode or fly to the ceiling or something, because maybe there aren't any. Even if there aren't any, they, objects with zero net forces on them don't accelerate. Why? Because, well, the statement is saying something about what those kind of objects are supposed to do, or are expected to do, or something along those lines. Whatever your theory, you know, I'm not going to, obviously not going to be precise about generics and laws and things of that nature. I'm just going to sort of take the fact that there seem to be non-trivial generics with empty antecedents. So here's some of the tests for generics. One is, can you use, does adverbial modification work? So you might think, suppose I flip a coin 10 times, and it comes up heads every time. I can't say, the flips are invariably heads. They were heads, they're not invariably heads. They were heads every time, right? They're not invariably, but you can say, you know, tigers invariably suckle their young, or something like that. And you can say, primes over 10 are invariably odd. That's just how it is with them. There's other tests as well. You can use indefinite. So if I say, again with the coin flip example, I can't say a flip of this coin comes up heads. But I can say a tiger suckles its young. I can say a prime over 10 is odd. And there's some other tests there too. And I'd be interested, I have a very poor grip on these tests. So if somebody knows about this and could help me, I'd appreciate it. Okay. So take this one, a body not subject to any force accelerates. That seems false, even if there are no such bodies, just because that's physically unlawful behavior for bodies like that. Why can't primes over 10 or even seem false for the same reason? Primes aren't like that. They're wrong about how numbers should behave qua objects of that sort. And this again suggests a nomological or generic component to arithmetical claims. Now, you might think that really can't be all there is to it, or it's not clear how the Kabbalistic rabbis who disbelieve in numbers can express their view. Because when they hear the sentence, there are many primes bigger than 10, they might, in some moods, think, actually, that's not right. There aren't any primes bigger than 10. There aren't any primes at all. They might think it's sort of a conversationally misleading way of putting it, like saying, somebody is, like I tell you, Alan Cove was sober today, right? That's true, he was sober today, but it's kind of a misleading thing to say because it sort of suggests that it doesn't usually happen. So I tried to offer Alan some wine the other day, he wouldn't take it, so, okay. All right, so if I say the number of primes over 10, if I say there are lots of primes over 10, and I really don't believe in numbers, that could be misleading. You might think, well, why did you pick on those ones to say they didn't exist? They all don't exist, okay? So primes over 10 are plentiful strikes the rabbis as false, but it's right about how numbers are supposed to behave. They are supposed to be plentiful. They are supposed to include among in their number plentiful primes over 10. So this might be seen to testify to a non-generic categorical component in Erich medical claims, postulating that the kind whose members should there be any behave like so actually does have members. There are things of the kind in question. You might think, look, even if you get something like primes are so and so, that's not really going to help with existential claims about primes. Like, there is an even prime. That doesn't have any sort of generic sound to it. But this has a generic sound to it. Numbers form groups that contain even primes. It's sort of like the one I have down here. Bees form colonies with a queen served by worker bees and drones. Okay, that would still be true even if there weren't any. We might actually have figured out how aliens would behave if they came. Sort of aliens sort of form armies with like ray guns in the front and blah blah blah. That could be true even if there aren't any aliens. Okay, one more thing. Yeah. So Erich medical claims on this view come up with two parts. Numbers are phi, and there are some numbers. And nominalists are presumably putting the first part forward as true, not the second. Or maybe they're putting the whole thing as true about a certain subject matter, like the zozine of numbers as opposed to the zine. So I'm gonna give one more kind of weird thing, and then I'll stop. It'll take about another. It might take. What time did I start? Do you have
that?
Five past. Can I have like five more minutes? Yeah. So our main loyalty in these Jamesian cases is not to the larger falsehood, but to the truth within. The larger falsehood is tolerated for its sake. You might ask, could it in principle go the other way? Could there be cases where our main loyalty is to the larger falsehood? So how would that be? Well, our thinking might be regulated by what on reflection are problematic principles, ones that we see when we think about it cannot hold in full generality. So just so story about how that could come about. So in the beginning, we lay down a certain principle as definitive of a certain concept, maybe the T-by conditionals or something like that for truth. Space had not yet opened up at that early time between the eventual subject matter of that claim we make, because we don't have like total control over time on what we're talking about. Space hadn't opened up between P's eventual subject matter and its ostensible subject matter, the thing that we thought we were talking about was actually just a part of O. So P was made definitive of the concept despite holding only of the smaller subject matter because we thought the smaller was the bigger. We didn't realize there was a difference. I'll give some examples in a sec. Why would P retain its hold on us when we realize this? As, for example, T-by conditionals have retained their hold on us when we realize it can't be maintained in full generality. Here's a bunch of possible reasons. P, the false principle, it has a clarity and simplicity that's lacking in weaker principles. Weaker principles aren't motivated. Things go better if we try to live up to P than really live up to a weakening, P minus. Nothing weaker gives proper guidance, etc. The weaker one would have us abandon reachable goals. Okay, so I've got two examples that I'll just say what they are, and then I won't say any more. So one of them is the truth example. So truth, you can imagine, in Eden, it was like postulated that truth would satisfy the T scheme, T-A if and only if A. Then new A's came along that sort of made that a bit difficult, like the liar sentence. Okay. The biconditional seemed sustainable then because we were talking about a class of sentences that we probably thought were all the sentences that there were. Self-reference had never occurred to us, perhaps. And now that we realize there's this problem, we might not want to abandon the principle for the same sort of reason that I gave a minute ago. Second example. So predicates, like red, you might think, are supposed to be applicable on the basis of casual observation. If you don't think that, read anything by Crispin Wright. He says, this is a very fundamental fact about their senses, whose sacrifice would be possible only at great cost, blah, blah, blah. So observationality means that the look of an object decides its color. So suppose that when we invented the word red, we thought we were talking about something observational. Call it observational red. We thought observational red was red. Turned out it wasn't. Why? What happens with the Sorites paradox? Well, there's like a forced march Sorites paradox there. Not all those premises are true. Everyone agrees not all those premises are true. The question is, how do you explain it? Okay. So, you know, lots of explanations around. They mostly explain why we don't realize they're false, not why we would think they were true. But here's an account of why we would think they were true. They are true of what we wanted to be talking about. It is true about observational red, the subject matter that counts worlds the same if the red things in them, let it be all the colored things in them, you know, aren't distinguishable by casual observation. All these, you know, if X is red, so is X prime, if X prime, so is X double prime, they're all true about observational red. So that's why we are attracted to those premises. Now you might think, look, aren't those premises, we still got a problem, because you could interpret those premises as being, ask yourself, are those premises true of observational red, the thing that we sort of thought we were talking about? I won't go into this, but there's basically two ways of treating that, and either way, you can't get the conclusion. You could think that they're individually true about observational red. In that case, the conclusion doesn't follow because, you can convince yourself, I can tell you why, truth about a subject matter is not closed under implication. Okay. You could think they're collectively true, but that would be a bad thing to think, because they're not really collectively true about observation, because the conclusion is clearly not true about observation, that this yellow thing is red. So at the very end, which I won't talk about, I mentioned some things that will come up next time, and I wish you would read that later, but I'll stop.